Matthew chapter 27 and verse 11. We're still in darkness. It started in chapter 26, verse 1. The darkness will continue. And in this scene, the dark scene, it depicts for us the central scandal of the gospel. Capture those words in your heart. It depicts the central scandal of the gospel, the good news. You see, up to this point in Matthew, there has not been the gospel that we preach today. In fact, some quite foolishly and immaturely and ignorantly have criticized the gospels for saying, well, it's not the gospel that we talk about in our churches. Up to this point, we've only heard things like, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. We have heard things like, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father. We have heard things like, sell all that you have, and then follow me, and you will inherit eternal life. We've heard time and time again of how what is not right, what is wicked, and what is right, what is righteous, and how we ought to do what is right. And that's not the gospel. We've heard God in human flesh teach us about what is right. But that's not the gospel. That's not scandalous to do what is right. Up to this point, Matthew hasn't told us. We've gotten a little picture in the Passover, in the meal. He gave us a picture there, and it was amazing. But as we grow closer to the cross, the picture becomes more gripping. And that's what we have before us. You see, what this is history. But I caution you, this is a record of events that tells more than history. You will see here illustration. You will see depiction. Real events that tell something beyond what the eye sees. Up to this point, we haven't seen the gospel so clearly. In fact, I dare say this perhaps is the clearest depiction of the scandal of the gospel in the whole Bible. At each turn in this passage, it is about bearing blame. Who's going to bear the blame? Judas doesn't want it. The scribes and Pharisees say it's not theirs. Pilate washes his hands. Who's going to bear the blame? At every point in this passage, that's what we see. So I want to show you three distinct aspects of bearing blame at the center of the scandal of the gospel as it's presented according to Matthew. Look at them with me one at a time. Number one, we see innocence. Innocence. This is really the point of the stress of this darkness and this whole kangaroo court trial. It's to underscore and accentuate and to spotlight the righteousness of Christ. The word in the Greek language that's used in verse 4, would you look at that with me? 27:4, this is when Judas spoke. He said, I have sinned and by betraying, what does it say? Innocent blood. Athoas in Greek. Athoas. It literally means not guilty. It means unworthy, undeserving of punishment. It means without fault. It's a legal concept. Righteous in the sense of legal righteous, not guilty. That's what Judas says. The man I'm betraying, the man you're going to kill, is not deserving to bear the blame. He's not deserving of punishment. Well, that's, I think, one of the great points of this whole drama. Look at verse 11. Now Jesus stood before the governor. What's happening here? We've kind of jumped in, and we need to kind of step back a little bit, and I'll pull very briefly just to paint the background for you. The props behind this spotlight on Jesus, the props are, well, he has been taken to Annas, the official high priest according to the Jews, and he was abused there. And then he was sent from there to Caiaphas, the technical high priest, and he was abused there. And then he was sent to Pilate, which Matthew records only in the beginning portion here. And then Pilate, finding out that he was a Galilean, sent him to Herod, and he was abused there. And Herod sent him back to Pilate. Why does it keep getting pushed around everywhere? He's not guilty, that's why. He's innocent. And every authority is trying some way to get something on him. And so it says, and the governor asked him this question. Look at it, verse 11. Are you the king of the Jews? Literally in the Greek, you could read it this way. You are the king of the Jews? There's probably spittle still matted in his beard. His face is swollen and beaten. You? The king of the Jews? This is absurdity. Really? Your people are bringing you to me, the Roman procurator, because you're a threat to Rome? You? The central point is they had to tell Pilate that he's claiming to be a king. Why? Because Rome could care less about their religious quibbles. It had to be political. It had to be something that Rome could say, no, you can't do that. And not only that, but something that Rome would say, no, you deserve death, capital punishment. The central point has to be political. So they go the route of insurrection. They go the route of sedition. This is a man who is seeking to revolt against the authority and power of Rome. Well, it's not incidental that in moments he will be mocked for being called a king. Look at, again, verse 11. Jesus said, "You have said so." He only says that three times. All three of them are in the darkness. All of them are in the passion narratives. He said it to Judas. When Judas says, "Is it I that's going to betray you?" "You said it." He said it to Caiaphas when Caiaphas says, "Tell me, are you the Christ?" "You said it." And now Pilate, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You said it." It's a striking way to answer. It's not an evasion. This isn't a tactic. This isn't a weak response. It's a very calculated response, you see, because it would be misleading to say yes, because the categories in Pilate's mind of what he's asking is not true. In other words, he's saying the affirmative, yes, it is true that I am a king, but not the way you think. The point, he responds to testify to his true identity and at the same time say, but I'm no criminal. I'm not worthy of death before Rome. I am not an insurrectionist. I'm innocent. In fact, this whole question is, if you read the parallel in John, is found in chapter 18, verse 36, and that's where John captures a little more of the dialogue, and this is where Jesus responds and says, "Yes, I am a king, but my kingdom is not of," do you remember? "This world. If it were of this world, you would be destroyed, and Rome is nothing." But yes, I am a king. So it's interesting. Each time he said, you said it, he said it in the past, a simple past, capturing what they said. And here he says it in a way that describes a different tense, in a way that says, this is what you are telling me, Pilate, and you're right. In other words, it clearly indicates Pilate was saying this more than once, and John captures that for us. You know, after the questioning, are you, and Jesus' affirmative, Luke gives us insight and tells us, this is the first time Pilate from his lips declares these words. Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. You brought him here as an insurrectionist. I've questioned him. He's not guilty. Well, that provokes the madness of the chief priests, and that brings us to verse 12. Look at it with me. But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? And again, the tense here is very strong. He uses a present infinitive with this continuous action. They keep accusing you. They keep testifying against you. Do you have no answer to this? Luke gives us insight. In chapter 23, 1 to 5, he tells us four things that they accused him of. Number one, subverting the nation. Number two, forbidding taxes to Caesar. Number three, claiming to be a king. And number four, going against or agitating the people, being one who disrupts the peace. All of those would be grounds for Rome to step in, because all of those would disrupt Rome's rule over these people. But only one of them is true. Do you know which one? He is the king. He is the king. He didn't forbid taxes. In fact, he commanded them to pay unto Caesar what is Caesar's. They're lying through their teeth. And this brings us to verse 14. But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. That word is a strong word. In fact, it has connections to our word in English for theater. Like, this is amazing. This is captivating. This is something surprising, astonishing. It's greatly amazing. And what was the amazement? Why? Why this amazement? Well, if you'll notice in the text, twice it says, verse 12 and 13, that he gave no answer. He gave no defense. Here's the issue. You see, Rome had a very, very particular and specific order of law and protocol. First of all, in a formal hearing before a procurator, there would be the charge. Secondly, there would be the evidence. Thirdly, there would be the defense. And fourth, there would be the verdict. Very simple. We kind of follow the same today. The point is, he's been brought forward and the charge was given. Now the accusations are made, there's the evidence. Step three in the process is the procurator listens to the defendant. And let me stress this. The defense was vitally important to the survival of one accused of capital punishment. In fact, one historian says this, in the Roman system, the defense depended heavily on the defendant's response. Accusations worthy of death elicited passionate defense. And this man stands silent. No defense. No defense. No explanation. No correction. No defense. What's the point? Well, I think something very important should be noticed. According to Roman law, if there was no defense, then it would force the verdict. The charge, the evidence, no defense, the verdict is guilty. Pilate's hand is forced. He knows he must punish him on the charges given. So he's astonished. He's greatly amazed because he sees in this man He's not guilty. Why don't you defend yourself? Well, because of a prophecy 742 years ago, you see. And it went something like this. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, he opened not his mouth. Pilate, you pathetic man. You know not what you're doing. This is much bigger than you or Rome or all the centuries combined. Well, he's silent. And you can't argue with silence, can you? J.C. Ryle says, to those silent sufferings, believers owe all their peace and hope. It's true. I found it striking in a new way as I meditated upon the text. I thought about, apart from his silence in this moment, I'd have no plea. When I stood before the judge, when I stand before him, I would have silence. I would have silence because I'm guilty and I have no defense. And so are you. His silence is what gives me a mouth to speak. His silence is what gives me a plea. Now I can speak before the judge of the universe. Well, I want you to notice all of this, all of it, every bit of it, is all to stress and color in the lines of his innocence. He doesn't give a defense. He doesn't need to. He's perfectly innocent, and all know it. Everyone knows it. Pilate knows it. Everyone knows it. Judas knew it. He said, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. Pilate's wife, look at verse 19. Claudia Procula, according to history. What a striking thing happens here. It says, besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, have nothing to do with that righteous man. Did you see that? Righteous man. For I have suffered much because of him today in a dream. Now, this is a striking thing, and I think we read it too fast. Look, the vice regent of Caesar is sitting on his bema seat of judgment. He is in session. You don't interrupt him. You don't interrupt him. And here comes this messenger. I'm sure his knees were knocking. Pilate, what is it? Claudia said something you need to hear. In fact, one noted rightly, what is this business? An aristocrat, Roman lady of high esteem, royal, she was the granddaughter of Augustus Caesar. This royal lady of Rome, what is she doing caring to intercede on behalf of a Galilean peasant? Well, in the ancient world, you see, it was a lot more superstitious than today. You can thank Christianity that superstition is squashed in many places, though atheists like to bite the hand that feeds. The world was filled with superstition. Julius Caesar was highly superstitious. Caesar Augustus was madly superstitious. And, well, so were the Romans here. And their ideas of dreams were that they were premonitions from the gods. They had to obey them, or they could suffer the consequences. So this was an urgent thing that could justify interruption, an urgent thing that was absolutely necessary to grab Pilate's attention. But what is the point? Jesus is righteous. That's the point. What is the reader supposed to take away? He's righteous. God will go through the most extensive providence to testify that he's righteous. I love what Spurgeon said. He goes, here was an unlooked for witness of the innocence of Christ. I love that, unlooked for. No one suspected this witness, but it fits. It fits the lineup. I mean, these are all unsuspecting witnesses here of innocence. In fact, Pilate, let's add him to the mix. Look at verse 24 at the end. He took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourself. Why would he say that unless he knew the man was innocent? And what he is doing is blood guilt. And he's trying to wash the blood guilt off of him. Every bit of it testifies to the innocence. Judas, Claudius, Pilate. It's crazy. And I find it crazy because the very people who should know he's innocent, namely the religious leaders, are the ones claiming he's guilty. Who are the ones claiming he's innocent? His betrayer, the Roman governor who could care less, and some unlooked-for witness of an aristocrat, Gentile female. You need to understand the context, right? Females weren't admitted for witnesses in these days. But it's not coincidental that it was a Syrophoenician Gentile woman who testified that he's the Lord when his own disciples didn't know. It's not coincidental that it was three magi, men from the Far East who came, Gentiles who came to worship him as king of the Jews when the Jews didn't know. It's not coincidence that all these witnesses are mounting up to testify the Gentiles see what the Jews do not. He's innocent. Are you with me? So let me run down a little bit of this statement. I'm going to go through these quickly, so I'll just give you the verses. I've put together a harmony of the text in this moment to show you how many times he is declared righteous or innocent or not guilty. Luke 23:4, Pilate said to the chief priests and crowds, I find no guilt in this man. Luke 23:14, you brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. After examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. And Pilate, remember, knew he was innocent, because look at verse 18 right here in our text. For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. What's the point? Pilate knew he wasn't guilty. It was envy that they delivered him up. Not for crime, but because of envy. Or how about look at verse 19? We just read this. The dream have nothing to do with this righteous man. John 19:4. Pilate went out again and said to them, see, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. Luke 23:22. A third time he said, why? What evil has he done? I find no guilt deserving of death, which is the parallel to our chapter, verse 23. And then look at Matthew 27, verse 24 again. Pilate says, washing his hands, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And finally, John chapter 19, verse 6. These are all distinct times. Pilate finally says, take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. The innocence of Jesus is repeatedly proclaimed. The first aspect of understanding the bearing of the blame is that he is righteous. He has no blame. He is perfectly innocent of all charges. He was pure and innocent, free from any iniquity or transgression against God or man. He was sinless. He is the one of whom it is said he went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed. He is the one of whom it was said that he always did what was right and pleasing to the Father. Yet, he was hated by the religious leaders. Why? Is it not because his righteousness? Is it not because he was righteous and they were not? Listen to John chapter 3, verse 19. Jesus speaks. This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. Did you see this? The light, hating the light, is not what we see before us, the light of pure righteousness and innocence, and people hating the light. It self testifies that he's righteous. Even their hatred reveals this. And it reminds me of what the prophet said. The prophet Jeremiah, chapter 23, verse 6. Speaking of the Messiah, he will come and his name will be called Yahweh Tzaddika. The Lord, our righteousness. Our righteousness. Or Acts chapter 7, verse 52, when they're stoning Stephen, the disciple, to death, he happens to say this: they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of, and I love it, he refers to Jesus as the righteous one, and whom you have now betrayed and murdered. Or how about 1 John chapter 2, for all of us who are in Christ know this to be your anchor. My little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. You see, beloved and friends, let me just draw this point to a close with, I pray, abundant clarity. That this Jesus is perfectly innocent, perfectly righteous, legally innocent, morally righteous, is vital to a right understanding of his death on the cross. As you read this narrative in the first century and you don't know what's going to happen and you're eager to find out and you see him going to a Roman gibbet for execution, you gotta ask, what did he do? Was he deserving of this? Then why did he die? It's vital to a right understanding of the cross. You don't get his innocence right, his righteousness right, you won't understand the cross. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. You see, the innocence of Christ is indispensable for atonement. If his blood will forgive your sin, he had to be spotless, blemishless, perfect without any sin. And so it is what we see in this first picture is he's the innocent one bearing the blame. We see right here, 2 Corinthians 5:21, we see, for our sake, the Father made him the Son to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. When you see, beloved and friends, when you see in just moments as you read the text, when you see the judgment of God upon Jesus in fierce wrath, when you see Jesus suffer and die on a cross, when you see these things, you are witnessing him dying, not on account of his own sin, but him dying on the account of the sins of other people. You see, Matthew hasn't explained this so clearly yet. Now we see in the darkness a brilliant light. Secondly, The first aspect of him bearing the blame is in his perfect innocence. The second aspect is in the injustice of it all. The injustice. I think Boyce said this very well. James Montgomery Boyce said, "Jewish law was the most humane of legal systems. It did everything possible to preserve life and avoid execution." What an indictment. It was the Jewish courts that brought him here. Not on the ground of evidence, but on the ground of a passionate, maddened, unreasoning hatred to terminate this life. But what about Roman legal systems? Well, there's an ancient saying, and it goes like this. Judea gave religion, Greece gave letters, Rome gave law. Judea gave religion, Greece gave letters, Rome gave law. They were known above all, considered the most highly developed law and system of law known to man. In all the ancient world, Rome was superior in its legal system. They had the most comprehensive and systematic of all. They were the most specific in their procedures, and they were the most exacting in their punishments. No coincidence. That's where we find Emmanuel. I want you to think with me. You've read the story, you've heard it read in your hearing this morning. But as you think through what happens here with Pilate, I want you to ask yourself, here's a man trained in the highest caliber of the law. Here's a man with the authority and power to grant and deny life in a legal system. And now I want you to think of this. What if this man were teaching law? What if he were in law school as a professor? Would this be a good example? Would this be something that you could put in a textbook for jurisprudence? This is how you deal with it. This is the principle of law. Could you do that with this story? Rome, who prided herself on her legal prowess and her expertise in law. What is she doing here? This is indeed the greatest miscarriage of justice in history. I mean, think of it with me. We've already rehearsed the innocence, have we not? In three times alone in the Gospel of John, he captures three times. I counted six total, aggregating all the accounts. In three times alone, though, in one gospel, you find this kind of a mentality. Pilate, the procurator, with all authority of law in his hand, look upon an innocent man and say three times, "I find no guilt, I find no guilt, I find no guilt. Crucify him." Just put the dots between. All the other dialogue fades in the distance. This is the point. "I find no guilt, crucify him." This is insanity of justice. This is inconceivable injustice. It is lawless legality. God had said in Proverbs 17:15, mark it down, Proverbs 17:15, "He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous are both alike an abomination to the Lord." Front and center, Pontius Pilate. Who is this man? He's a high Roman official. He's trained in the administration of justice. He's called a governor, he's called a prefect, and he's called a procurator. He was appointed in 26 AD, not very many years before of this scene. He was the sixth procurator of Judea. There's an inscription that was found in the 60s in Caesarea Philippi, on a marble stone, "Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea." Well, what is a procurator or a prefect? Well, a procurator is an agent of the emperor. He's one who has the delegate authority over the finances of the empire in that region. He also has all legal authority that trumps any other vassal. He is truly the mouth of Caesar in this moment. A prefect is a more general term that describes a senior magistrate or governor in the ancient Roman world, and he had various functions and responsibilities. That's his office. What's his character? Well, I don't want to spend too much time. He's not worthy of it. But I must share with you what Philo said, not me. Philo was a historian that lived during the time. He lived during the time of Pilate. He says this: he was a man of very inflexible disposition, a very merciless, as well as a very obstinate man. In respect of his corruption, his acts of insolence, and his habit of insulting people, his cruelty, his continual murders of people, untried and uncondemned, and his never-ending and gratuitous and most grievous inhumanity. He was exceedingly angry, and being at all times a man of most ferocious passions. And then he sums it up. I'm skipping. He says a lot in between those things. And then he says he was a man who never wished to do anything which could be acceptable to his subjects. He did not care for the Jews. In fact, there are a couple of incidents that history records, one that Scripture records. History tells us about when he first took the scepter over Judea. You know what he did? He decided, this is what I'll do. I hear about these pesky Jews and how they have this belief about no images. So in the nighttime, Bears betrays his guilt. He brings Roman soldiers and brings these massive standards with the image of Caesar on them right on in to Jerusalem and sets them up everywhere, even by the temple. And the Jews go mad. And they send a delegate to the next office to report it to Caesar. Caesar doesn't take it well. In fact, Tiberius was on the throne at that time, and he wrote this, I quote, Tiberius wrote a letter, this is Philo reporting it, Tiberius wrote a letter reproaching and reviling him, Pilate, in the most bitter manner for his act of unprecedented audacity and wickedness. And it goes on to talk about how he threatened Pilate that if he didn't take those images out of there immediately, that Pilate himself would be deposed. Well, then there happened to be another thing that he did. As procurator, he just reached right on in to the treasury of the temple and took out all the money he wanted to pay for an aqueduct to be built, bringing water to Jerusalem. And he thought, of course, you can't complain. I'm serving your people. And they said that money was not for the people. That was devoted to God. So a massacre took place. They protested in public, and Pilate put men in cloaks, Roman men in cloaks, out among the people with swords and with clubs, and they beat and murdered hundreds of people in the group just to shut them up. He didn't care. And then Luke tells us in chapter 13, verse 1, that there was some were present at the very time who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. There's something there that happens, and there's history behind that I won't get into. Let me just make this clear and sum it up and move us forward. The point here is the injustice. This man was not a just man. He was a cruel man. But he saw that Jesus was not guilty, and he saw that the Jews, the leaders, were. And with that knowledge, that Jesus is innocent, and that they are guilty, he still fails to uphold justice. So what we see here is his utter incompetence, his cowardice to evade responsibility. He simply evades responsibility. The purpose of this trial, he knew well, was not to punish a violator of law. but to eliminate an innocent life. And he went forward. He did not stand up with the power he had to say, go back to your places. This man's innocent. I release him. He had every power to do that. But he didn't. So some people have said, well, look at his attitude toward Jesus. He admired him. I don't think he admired Jesus. I think what he did was more hatred towards those who offered him up than any care for Jesus himself. You could see it if you read John's account. He didn't show any true dignity to Jesus. He yelled at him and said, what, do you think I'm a Jew? You think I know your system? And then he walks away from him. What an insult. No. The only thing that we should see here in his passion is a hatred for these chief priests who delivered him up. So he offers to punish Jesus and let him go because, well, he knows he's innocent. He knows they're guilty, but they deny it, which only agitates Pilate more. So then he makes his decision, and his decision is innocent. In fact, it's recorded. You can mark it down. Acts chapter 3, verse 13 to 15. Listen to what it says in verse 13. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, Peter is speaking, whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. Peter tells the Jews, Pilate decided to release him. All right? Well, the problem is, why didn't he then? Why didn't he then? Sure, he knew so well that he did decide to release him. Is that justice? No. Not just pronouncement, but execution is justice. Not just saying what's right, but following through to do it. He didn't do it because he was a coward. And when he offered this decision, I find him innocent, I'll just punish him and let him go, this is the response, John 19:12. Then on Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. And then in verse 15, he says, shall I crucify your king then? And they respond, we have no king but Caesar. Well, what's the point here? I'm trying to make very simple. He knew what was right. He didn't do it because he was a coward. And to save his own skin, he let injustice have its day. He was manipulated. He was played with a political piece. I don't want Caesar. I'm already sort of in probation. I don't want Caesar to take away my power and luxury. So he says in verse 22, then what shall I do with Jesus who is called the Christ? And I find it striking, he mentions that twice. Who is called the Christ? Who is called the Christ? He's clearly trying to avoid death penalty. But what is he doing? He's abdicating his responsibility, isn't he? Imagine this. You're before the Supreme Court. You got a serial murderer on trial. The judge steps down from the bench and he walks out to the audience and says, what do you think I should do? What? There's no law system in the world that would think that's just. What do you think I should do? We're the criminal idiots that brought him to you. What are you asking us for? Of course we want him killed. What kind of man is this? What do you think I should do? And then he says, what evil has he done? Well, it is the responsibility of justice to condemn the guilty and to acquit the innocent. That is what justice is for. But listen to what Pilate did. First of all, in his first examination, number one, he passes him off to Herod, playing the card of jurisdiction. Number two, he offers to punish him and then release him. That's just an appeasement at the expense of the victim, legal victim. Number three, he then chooses to make this diversion with another criminal. Number four, he then punishes Jesus and brings him back before the crowd to incite pity, to try to change the verdict. And number five, he declares him innocent multiple times. Number six, he washes his hands to disown any responsibility. This is injustice at fever pitch. Look at verse 24 with me. So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. He's seeking to absolve himself, just like Judas did. Throw the coins back. Go hang yourself. Absolve yourself. No. Not all the water in the world would wash away the blood on his hands. And just think of it this way for application. This was a ceremony, right? You bring out a water, you wash in front of the people so they could see, I'm washing my hands. I'm not guilty. Ceremony just... Look, no ceremony in the world, no ceremony in the world can wash away your guilt. And that's what religion offers, is ceremonies. Doesn't matter what you say, doesn't matter what you do. Where's your heart? Verse 25, and all the people answered, his blood be on us and our children. Who's bearing the blame? They're audaciously saying, we'll take the blame. You don't need to bear it, Pilate. We could tell you can't handle it. We'll bear it. It reminds me of what Jesus said the last day he was with them in the temple, and he said, woe to you, woe to you, woe to you. And he closed it by saying, all of these judgments will come upon this generation. Woe to you. I'm sure some standing there in that crowd who heard that, we'll take it on our heads, were standing there in 70 AD when Vespasian Titus came and destroyed them. Well, I must hasten to the last and final, and that is the illustration. You see, a picture is worth a thousand words, right? Even a picture that's written. And that's what we have. The ultimate meaning of this scene is far too deep for words, I would say. You kind of have to step back, and strive to just understand what is happening here. You notice I skipped the little piece in the middle, right? Which is really the centerpiece of the whole passage, which is really the story. It's not just about the innocence, that was necessary. It's not just about the injustice, because that was necessary. He's an innocent man, but he must die. So it could only happen through the injustice of wicked men, and all parties are guilty. But now I want you to see with me the illustration. Exactly what is the picture that depicts the scandal of the gospel? Well, it's right here. Not only do we have the evasion of responsibility, but what we have is he comes up with a strategy to get out from under, to get off the hook. And here's his brilliant strategy. Look at it, verse 15. Now, the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. Amnesty. It's all political. It was to gain favor with a rabble people that he was already in disfavor with. And he saw the brilliant opportunity. I'm between a rock and a hard place. It feels like checkmate, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to score, get their favor, please the people. I'll be able to snub the nose of those chief priests, and I'm off the hook. It's not my decision. They'll decide. Or so he thought. Because I'm fully convinced the only reason he'd do this is because he thought the crowd would choose Barabbas. Who is this? Look at it with me. Verse 20 or 16, and they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. You've probably heard it. Bar means son, Abba, father, Barabbas, son of the father. The irony is thick. He's called here notorious. Means he's marked, he's signed, he's stamped, he's noteworthy. He's someone who is distinct and set apart. He bears this like a cane mark on him. He's marked. And about what? What is it about? Well, Mark 15, 7. The Gospel of Mark, chapter 15, verse 7 says, and among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection was a man called Barabbas. He's a rebel, an insurrectionist. Luke 23:19 tells us he was a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. He was a leader among the insurrectionists. In John 18:40, it says, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. But that word again, robber, lestes, is the word for insurrectionist. The lexicons tell us it's one who seizes by violence. In contrast to kleptes, like kleptomaniac, means one who steals something, a robber by stealth. That's not this. This is lestes. That means one who takes violently. But it's used most often politically as one who is an insurrectionist, a revolutionary, a rebel. One translation translates it, he was a freedom fighter. Another one, he was a revolutionary. Another one, he was a terrorist. Josephus notes that these groups of men by this name, these lestes, these were the zealots. These were the zealots, and Barabbas was a leader of the zealots. Now catch with me the irony of this all. Think with me about this. This man is a rebel, a criminal, a murderer, an enemy of Rome, unashamed. He hates Rome. He's murdered Romans. He's led an insurrection. He is a threat to Rome. He is guilty as charged. He is facing justice. He deserves chains. He deserves punishment. In fact, listen to the bit of the history that just makes perfect sense here. There were three men up for crucifixion that day. Three men. None of them were Jesus. Two insurrectionists, and in the middle, their leader, Barabbas. Now, this custom that Pilate had of amnesty at Pesach, at the Passover, this custom, he didn't operate it as normal. Anyone you choose. No. He forced the choice. He said, you only have two choices. This Jesus, who is called the Christ, or this Barabbas. Violent, murderous man. Why did he choose Barabbas? Wouldn't he choose Barabbas? He's trying to get out of it, remember? Wouldn't he choose Barabbas only if Barabbas was just about the very worst criminal he could possibly find? Wouldn't he choose Barabbas if he was disgusting and he thought that the crowds would acknowledge the same? Wasn't he manipulating and trying to get the crowds to say, yeah, of course, how can we kill Jesus next to him? This guy, no matter what Jesus has done or said, this man. So clearly Barabbas is, he is one who is fully and completely deserving without a plea. Look at verse 17 as we try to draw this up to a close. So then when they gathered, and this shows us that they weren't all there at this time. All the initial proceedings, they weren't there, but now people are coming. Now people are coming, probably solicited to come. All the right kind, you know. Chief priests and scribes, hey, why don't you come? And Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release for you? Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ? Verse 18, for he knew that it was out of envy. Verse 19, his wife interrupted the process. Have nothing to do with that righteous man. Verse 20, now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Apparently, while Pilate is being interrupted, they're doing their dirty work. The question has already been posed, which one? You choose. They haven't screamed yet. Now they're doing their dirty work. Choose Barabbas. And now, verse 21. Oh, and isn't it an irony, isn't it? I mean, they're persuading him. I mean, just think about this. Rome is going to crucify him because they think his kingdom is of this world. The chief priests have put him up for crucifixion because they think his kingdom is not of this world. There's a no-win. Both of them hate him for different reasons. And here we find now that they want to They want Barabbas, a man who is in fact guilty of the very thing they're charging Jesus with. They're calling Jesus an insurrectionist when he's not. And now they're saying, no, choose Barabbas. We actually want the one who is guilty. And we want to destroy the one who is innocent. And verse 27, the governor said to them, which of the two do you want me to release for you? And they said, Barabbas, not his plan. Verse 22, Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? And they all said, let him be crucified. And he said, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, let him be crucified. This is a mob mentality. They've sacrificed all logic and they are just operating on passion. They want to eliminate Jesus. This is the picture of the one who was despised and rejected of men. You see, it didn't matter how righteous Jesus was or how guilty Barabbas was. It had nothing to do with their choice. This was entirely based upon their own hearts' passions. Do you see how dangerous our passions can be? They didn't love Barabbas. They didn't want him. They just hated Jesus. And this Barabbas, this one who deserves chains, this one who deserves crucifixion, this one who was an enemy of Rome and a violator of God. But this is the point. Let me step back and just remind you and help us all to just really see who's bearing the blame. What is the picture for? What does the picture tell? It's not so much about who you choose. It's more about, I am Barabbas. It's more about the picture that you should understand when you see Christ die on the cross. He is the innocent one dying in the place of the guilty one. Literally, we have the most indisputable picture of substitution. The guilty, vile sinner who did not need to be released, who was rightly prepared for judgment. He had no plea. The guilty, vile sinner is chosen by God's extending grace because Jesus is chosen to die in his place. So here we have Christ being treated as Barabbas, as though he was the greatest of criminals. It wasn't for a good man he died. And the same is true for us. He didn't have to be released, Barabbas. Neither do we. His punishment would have been just, and so would ours. It wasn't right that Christ died on that cross. Oh, this is true for us too. This man, Barabbas, was without hope. He was without plea. He had a life sentence without the possibility of parole. But Jesus was really the true Son of the Father, doing the Father's will, pleasing the Father. Jesus was the one who deserved to be set free, not Barabbas. Barabbas was freed, liberated, because Christ was condemned. This, beloved and friends, I must close, is the foolishness of the cross. It's the foolishness of the gospel, that Paul would say. This is the foolishness of the gospel. No one would look at that and say, that just makes perfect sense. No, it doesn't make sense. He's perfectly righteous. Injustice killed him. And he took the place of the most vile sinner. And that's our hope. When we see the death of Christ on the cross, we remember it was for us. We remember we're set free too. And let's just close with this thought. We remember Jesus bearing our blame, not just Barabbas's. And who among the disciples? Once, can you just imagine with me Barabbas being released and walking down the praetorium steps? Imagine Peter and John running up and hugging him. No. Imagine Barabbas thinking, I'm going to go back to all that I did. No. We know nothing about what he did, but this I know. The intensity of that moment is a lesson for us all. Barabbas is like our old man. Run from him. Never go back to those ways. And seek to delight not in your guilt, but delight in the grace that freed you. Let me close this with that quote from Octavius Winslow once again. How fitting it is. Who delivered up Jesus to die? Not Judas for money, not Pilate for fear, not the Jews for envy, but the Father for love. Let's pray. Thank you, Father. Grant us now hearts to believe. Show us through the picture of Barabbas who we are. Show us through the picture of Jesus exactly who you are. And help us, I pray, to worship you in spirit and truth, to delight our hearts in the grace and love that you bestow, to walk out of here with an increasing desire to honor you, to please you, to testify to you, about you to all the world. Give us the strength and comfort in the face of death, in the face of tragedy, even in the face of tyranny. Help us to trust you in all things, for this being true changes everything. For the glory of Christ, we pray. Amen.